The date is June 6, 1997, and we're watching Con Air. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Our one very loyal listener in France, bonjour. Welcome back to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. I am your host, Sean Wells, and with me is my co-host,
Colin Stewart.
And today we are also joined via Zoom by a man who is a co-founder and performer in a local improv comedy troupe here in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, called Good Improv, Mr. Jordan Ward. Jordan, how the hell are you?
Oh, Sean, I'm having a great day, and thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, we're excited. I mean, I'm especially excited. Not only have we hit double digits of our show, I know that's a low milestone for a lot of people, but this is episode 10, so I'm excited about that. But if you're listening to this on the release day, it is also my birthday. So this is a very exciting day for me. This week we are looking
Should we sing you happy birthday?
Is that one that you still have to pay for if we want to use that tune?
I don't know, and I don't want to get sued. So let's just continue on.
So this week we're looking back at June 1997 when the movies in theaters were The Fifth Element, Gone Fishing, Austin Powers: International Man of Mystery, The Lost World, Jurassic Park. And, of course, our movie for today, Con Air, which earned $224 million on a $75 million budget. It should also be noted that 3 weeks after the release of this movie, Face Off was also released. So there was double the pleasure, double the Nick Cage in theaters at the time, in late June.
And as always, just our friendly disclaimer, there will be spoilers ahead. The movie is quite old, so I mean, if you haven't seen it and you don't want to be spoiled, hit pause, go watch it, then come back and hear what we have to say.
So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "One wrong flight can ruin your whole day." That's that may not be the best description, so we'll go to Colin for a 60-second synopsis.
All right. Con Air stars Nicolas Cage as Cameron Poe, a former Army Ranger wrongfully convicted of manslaughter after killing a man in self-defense. After serving his 10-year sentence, Poe is released from prison longing to see his wife and the daughter he's never met. To get there, he is given a ride on a prisoner transport plane along with some of the most deadly and dangerous convicts in the country, including Cyrus the Virus Grissom. Poe's plans for a family reunion are put into jeopardy when Cyrus and some of the other inmates manage to escape, kill some of the guards on board, and take over the plane, establishing what Cyrus refers to as Con Air. Now trapped in the sky, Poe works to keep himself alive in order to protect the innocents on board and prevent the convicts from accomplishing their plan of fleeing the country.
Okay, so Jordan, you're our special guest today. I gave you the option of a couple different movies to watch, one of which was Short Circuit, which we did last week. What was it about Con Air that was so appealing to you?
I think one of the main things is that Con Air blurs the line between a great action movie and a bad action movie.
That's a good way of putting it.
It's really hard to tell when it stops being great and starts becoming terrible because there's so much in there. Things are constantly exploding. You know, it's so over the top. You got Nicolas Cage with this amazing flowing hair.
Oh,
it's got a lot going on.
Absolute, like, Herculean. Just this gorgeous, gorgeous head of hair. Yet he's still got the widow's peaks, you know.
Yeah,
for me, this was one of those ones that came out just after I graduated high school. And so it was one of those that I remember seeing in the theaters because it's just one of those mindless popcorn summer movies that you got to go see. Colin, what is your experience with Con Air?
So I watched this movie well after it came out, I think when I was in university, because one of my friends was recommending me a bunch of Nicolas Cage movies, and I love this movie. This movie, like you said, Face Off, which came out right after it, and The Rock, they make Nicolas Cage seem like a competent or like a bankable actor compared to what he's done more recently. So it was really interesting for me going back and watching this movie and remembering that that's Nicolas Cage and thinking about like Ghost Rider and Left Behind and all these other like weird direct-to-DVD movies.
Wicker Man was a bizarre one as well.
Yeah.
Alrighty, well, let's jump into Con Air. It's directed by Simon West, who is making his feature film debut. Future films include The General's Daughter, Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, Expendables 2, Back for War. I didn't realize that that had a little side name to the movie, was the Back for War. Previously, he was a commercial director, though. He's famous for the Budweiser Frogs and Truck commercial. And he was also a music video director. The best video that he directed was Never Gonna Give You Up, Never Gonna Let You Down. Right? That's right. He was the director of the Rick Astley Never Gonna Give You Up video. It's produced by... Well, normally what I do is I talk about like the executive producers that are listed on IMDb. But in this movie, there are five listed. They are Peter Bogart, Jonathan Hansley, Jim Koof, Lynn Koof, and Brad Oman. But strangely, the one that I expected to be listed as executive producer is Jerry Bruckheimer, because that's the name above the title on the poster. But he's just listed as a regular old producer. But come on, I mean, this is a Jerry Bruckheimer movie. This is mindless Jerry Bruckheimer action at its best. If you don't know who he is, he's responsible for movies like The Culpepper Cattle Company, Rafferty and the Gold Dust Twins, Farewell, My Lovely, March or Die, and American Gigolo. I'm just messing with you. Those are his first five movies, but he's also responsible for Top Gun, The Rock, Bad Boys, Pirates of the Caribbean, Armageddon, National Treasure, CSI, Amazing Race. I'm always mistaking stuff that Michael Bay does because the styles of film are very so similar. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I always thought that Transformers was a Jerry Bruckheimer movie.
And then
I went and looked it up for this because I was like, why didn't that appear in his credit list? And then I realized that Transformers isn't Michael Bay either.
It's not.
There were different producers listed, unless I'm like,
no,
just
Michael Bay directed Transformers.
Yeah, he was the director.
It wasn't like a Michael Bay production. It was.
I guess I don't really think of Michael Bay as a producer. I think more of him as a.
I suppose so. Yeah. Guess,
that's generous to think of Michael Bay as a director. Well, yeah. He does direct movies. So that's a very accurate description of what he does.
He yells action.
Mostly he just blows stuff up.
and makes robots bleed for some reason.
Hey everybody, Editing Sean here. I just want to say, I'm not sure what past Sean was thinking. Maybe he was stoned or drunk when he was doing his research, but Michael Bay is an executive producer on Transformers. So if you've started writing a tweet or an email to us, you can just delete that because I'm already aware of my mistake. My apologies. And now, back to the show.
This movie is written by Scott Rosenberg, who did High Fidelity, Gone in 60 Seconds, Venom, both of the new Jumanji movies, and Kangaroo Jack, which is also Jerry Bruckheimer. It could be argued that maybe Dave Chappelle should also have a credit here because I read that he improvised most of his lines for this movie. So we open the movie on news footage of war with a very patriotic speech about duty, freedom, and sacrifice being played over it before we are taken to Mobile, Alabama, home of Forrest Gump, where we get to meet our hero, Cameron Poe, who is played by the amazing Nicolas Cage, as someone who is simultaneously in some of the worst movies and some of the best movies out there.
It's just the law of averages. If you're in enough movies, that'll just be true.
Well, I feel like he's very much like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon that you could play. I feel like you could play it with Nicolas Cage too, which as I was researching for this movie, I definitely noticed a lot of Nicolas Cage parallels. But okay, come on, guys. I didn't ask this before, but what is your top three Nicolas Cage movies then? I think for me, I'd have to go Raising Arizona. I love Raising Arizona. Gone in 60 Seconds and Face Off. Those are probably my top three Nick Cage.
Mine would be between Con Air and The Rock.
Con Air and The Rock?
Yeah.
Oh, those are good. Yeah, those are all good movies. Jeez, for Nicolas Cage, I mean, there's so many to choose from. Probably Ghost Rider has got to be on there.
Oh, you've got to be shitting me. Really?
Oh, yeah, there's a scene in there where he's Johnny Blaze. You know, he's a real cool guy. And he walks into his sort of studio apartment there because he's like real, you know, top bachelor.
Yeah.
And he grabs a glass, a martini glass, and it's full of jelly beans. And he swirls it like it's a real drink and he takes a sip from it, you know. And it was the most committed acting I've ever seen.
Well, that's true. Nicolas Cage always goes all out.
Yeah. I have to give honorable mention to him playing Spider-Man Noir in Into the Spider-Verse.
So, oh, that's good, yeah. And he was almost Superman. That's probably my top Nicolas Cage film. The Superman film that never was.
Yeah, oh, those pictures, those are horrendous. The ones that, you know, he's got like a rubber Superman suit. Yeah, I do wonder what a Superman movie with Nicolas Cage in the lead would have been like, that's for sure.
Well, I was actually wondering, because he's in such good shape, like there's that part where he's in prison, he's doing like handstand
push-ups. He is pretty jacked.
And I was thinking that this must have been around the time as well that the Superman movie was in production.
I wonder
if he was getting in shape to play Superman at the time.
Yeah, because it was something that was pre-Superman Returns, and that was, what, 2006, was it that late?
Well, I'll tell you this, if that film ever gets made or the footage is ever released, I guarantee you that it will be more action than a person deserves to be treated to.
It's going to be like Superman on Red Bull and some sort of crack cocaine, you know. With a NOS booster. So Cameron Poe is dressed in his full Army Ranger gear, and he is home at the bar to see his wife, Trisha Poe, where she works, played by Monica Potter, who was in Patch Adams, Saw, Boston Legal, but probably best known for her role on Parenthood. Now, already, right off the bat, I'm confused about something, and I need to check with you guys to see if I missed something. Cameron Poe is also kissing her belly and saying hello to his unborn child, but I'm under the impression that he was deployed at war and he's been gone for a while. She definitely does not look very pregnant, so can someone help me with the math here? Like, was there a furlough that, like, was he home for a little while a couple months ago?
I mean, we have to assume, I guess. That's actually a very astute observation that I never picked up on, even though I've just had a new baby.
Yeah, that's one flat-bellied pregnant woman right there. I'd say 3-4 months at the most to be showing as little as she was. That
she doesn't even look like she's at the point that she would know she's pregnant. Like she was.
Yeah,
she didn't know, but Cameron Poe knew.
Look, because he's got that Nick Cage sixth sense.
Powerful, yeah. He probably instinctually knew that he had impregnated her. I don't know if you've seen how strong this guy is in this film, but he'll roundhouse kick a man, and the man will almost explode.
So this was him being a pregnancy test for her. This was him breaking the news to her that line is going to be blue on the pregnancy test.
I think they slept together once he got back from military stuff.
Yeah.
And then it was just boom, he knew, you know.
Oh, so this was pre. So he was even like precognitive of this pregnancy, because like he slept with her after killing the guy, and then
between the time he's arrested and the time he killed the guy, he slept with her.
but he already knew that she was pregnant. Their reunion is interrupted by a couple of belligerent assholes who are regular at Trisha's bar, picking a fight with a fully uniformed soldier, and we get a brief glimpse that Cameron has a bit of a dark side, and that the army and Trisha are what keeps him on the straight and narrow. They dance a bit to Leanne Rimes before the scene cuts to outside in the rain where Poe's are getting into their El Camino to leave, but we see the guys from the bar are lying in wait for them because they hold an inexplicable grudge. They're upset that this guy is married to the hottest waitress or something. We get three against Poe, a knife pulled, and Cameron Poe palm punching someone's bone cartilage into his brain and killing him. Oh, I always love that as a finishing move.
My favorite part of that fight is the fact that he's at his car door.
Yeah.
Like, he could easily have just gotten into the car.
Yeah.
But he sees the guys, like, jaw-jacking him. And then he walks straight into the center of the three. And it makes for a little bit of problems later when he's trying to make his self-defense claim, I think. But...
Well, yeah, so we're now at the courthouse where Cameron's lawyer recommends pleading guilty to manslaughter, thinking that he'll only get a few years and probably be out in one. But the judge disagrees with him because his military training makes him a deadly weapon and sentences him to 7 to 10 years. We now get a letter writing montage between Cameron and his wife and the daughter where we see how Cameron spends his prison time working out in his cell, learning Spanish and origami, avoiding everyone else, and eating the snacks Trisha has sent to him, like the pink coconut things. What are they? Let's go to Sponsorship Corner to find out! As always, I enjoy finding obvious product placements in movies, so today, Con Air is brought to you by Hostess Snowballs, the pink coconut things, Doritos, Miller Lite, Volvo, Coca-Cola, Marlboro, Hard Rock Cafe, and Chevrolet, which is oddly highlighted with a few cleverly placed pickup trucks, but there is actually very little emphasis on that very sexy classic Corvette. They don't show a whole lot of signage on that Corvette. But also a few honorable mentions. There are two references to Disney things, Lady and the Tramp and Going to Disneyland, which is fitting because this is a Touchstone movie, which is a company owned by Disney. Also, a filing cabinet in the police station that has a prominently displayed DARE sticker, Drug Abuse Resistance Education, if you don't know what DARE stands for. And I don't know what on the Vegas Strip is actually intentional product placement. Like, there's a very noticeable McDonald's sign and the names of several hotels, but we've discussed in past episodes that McDonald's doesn't like attaching itself to R-rated movies. So there may be sponsors, but maybe just because there's no way to film the Vegas Strip without showing them. Maybe sponsored by Las Vegas? And this has been Sponsorship Corner. So, Cameron has been paroled. He is reading a letter from his daughter, who is excited that she gets to meet her daddy for the first time on her birthday. And his only prison friend, Baby O, who is played by Mykelty? I'm going to say Mykelty Williamson, who was in Heat. He played Don King in Ali, reoccurring roles in 24, Justified, CSI New York, Nashville, Chicago PD, but he's probably best known as Benjamin Buford Bubba Blue in Forrest Gump. There are a lot of moments where I can't unsee Bubba in this movie. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but like when he's shot at one point, it's very much like Bubba's death scene in Forrest Gump at that point for me. They are talking about the stuffed rabbit that Cameron has bought his daughter in the prison commissary. A very odd thing to stock in a commissary. He literally says it was this or a pack of smokes. So why is a prison stocking stuffed rabbits in their prison commissary?
We have to think that they have people visiting. Like, families would go visit, so maybe it provides the inmate the option of giving a gift. But then you also run the risk of having, like, 10 children all show up and leave with the same rabbit, which that wouldn't make for a good memory, I don't think.
Well, some of the parents would probably just buy the pack of Pall Malls.
Yeah.
Well, and in this prison he's in, isn't it also the worst of the worst?
I don't think it's this prison that's... I think everyone's being transferred to a new state-of-the-art facility in Louisiana. That's why all the worst of the worst are on this plane, is because they're getting sent to a better prison for keeping the worst.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So now we meet some of the Department of Corrections agents preparing for the inaugural flight of the jailbird and talking about how all of these prisoners are being transferred to, a new state-of-the-art facility in Louisiana. The agent in charge is Vince Larkin, played by John Cusack from 16 Candles, Say Anything, Gross Point Blank, High Fidelity, Hot Tub, Time Machine, and here's the Nick Cage connection, adaptation with Nick Cage. We also meet his sidekick, Ginny, who is played by Angela Featherstone, who was Linda in The Wedding Singer. That's the only thing I know her from when I looked at her IMDb. And they are forced to cooperate with the DEA, who is represented by Dr. Duncan Malloy, Cole Meany, who was in Layer Cake, Under Siege, Die Hard 2, but most famous as Chief O'Brien on Star Trek The Next Generation and Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Malloy proves what a dick he is by pulling up in his classic Corvette with the license plate Ass Kicker, A-Z-Z-K-I-K-R, and promptly parking in a handicap spot. That's one of the things that Jerry Bruckheimer and Michael Bay really have no subtlety of, is just these very obvious washes of what a character is in order to find out, you know, with very little exposition. Because you don't want exposition in a Jerry Bruckheimer movie.
No, yeah. No. I thought what you were going to say they were terrible at hiding was their hatred for the disabled. They go out of their way to show this guy parking in a handicap stall. It's like, what could be a worse thing for a person in a wheelchair or whatever other disability you can park for, you know?
I want to see the scene that happens like 5 minutes later when the guy pulls up thinking he's going to get on his private plane and, oh good, there's a handicap spot right on the tarmac. And, oh, son of a bitch! Gets him towed. Oh, that would be great. So from the control room in the truck, we meet Agent Willie Sims, played by Jose Zuniga, who was in Alive, Twilight, Madam Secretary, and Nick Cage Connection, the movie Next. And he's a DEA agent that they want to put undercover on the plane, wearing a super bulky wire with a tape recorder, like bigger than an iPad. And he wants to get someone to talk. Did they even explain who? Because no one on the plane knows that he's undercover. So how could they even guarantee that he's sitting next to the correct person?
It's actually, I didn't even understand that part until I read the Wikipedia, like, full synopsis of this movie. And I guess the person that they wanted him to speak to was a drug lord that they were going to pick up when they got to Carson City.
Oh, he's a Carson City guy. Okay. Yeah. But I'm just trying to think of the people that actually got on in Carson City. Were any of them, like, labeled as drug lords? There's the one guy that's supposed to have the plane waiting for them at Lerner's Airfield. Was that the drug lord?
I'm not sure. I'm trying to think of who the, like, big bads they brought on.
But the...
He's dead by that time anyways.
Pretty much. But, I mean, it's not assigned seating. The plane isn't full, so I don't even understand why people are sitting next to each other anyway.
Yeah, if the logic is that they're going to put him on the plane so he can talk to this guy, but none of the guards are in on it, so the guards wouldn't even necessarily know to position this guy next to him, and they're all start off shackled to their chair.
Yeah.
So how would you... Unless it was going to be like, maybe he was going to the prison in Carson City?
Maybe. I assumed the whole sting was supposed to take place on the plane. Which is why they were cooperating with John Cusack in the first place.
It makes sense if you're on a flight that long. You know, you might as well sit down next to someone and have a chat.
Yeah.
Especially these prisoners. They're probably stuck in a cell with the same guy. Imagine you're in the same cell with a guy for, you know, 8 years, 5 years, whatever it is.
And there's no...
You're on a plane.
There's no in-flight entertainment, no magazines.
Yeah.
You gotta talk.
I don't know, man. Their whole thing is they want to get this plane, right?
Yeah.
And it's, to me, it seemed like their real plan was to start their own airline. They were just real bad at it. Makes sense. Once you got the plane, you know, the rest is kind of downhill, so to speak.
Well, the Conair system is relatively new. I was reading an article that was saying that the actual, like, real-life Conair system only began in 1995.
It's real?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought this was, like, complete bullshit. I didn't even bother Googling that. I didn't think it was real.
No, is that program based on this film? Like, the success of...
Well, no, because he said 95. No,
the film is based on an article that the writer read just about this new system that was being implemented to transport...
That,
prisoners.
You know, yeah, that tracks for a Jerry Bruckheimer, a movie based on an article.
Yeah.
So we find out that the DEA agent won't be allowed to bring a weapon on the plane, much to Malloy's protests. He's told there's a small arsenal in the belly of the plane, a pistol in the lockbox in the cockpit, and that's it. And the guards aren't even armed. So we get a bit of an introduction montage for all the criminals, which is narrated by John Cusack at this point. And now all the white guys start talking like they're either racist or from the hood. Lines like, who's this handsome brother? Well, the handsome brother in question is Diamond Dog, played by Ving Rhames, who is from Pulp Fiction, Mission Impossible, Dawn of the Dead. Here's the Nick Cage connection, Bringing Out the Dead, and voice work is Cobra Bubbles and Lilo and Stitch, and of course he's the We've Got the Meats guy from Arby's, and we see him frisked by Guard Falzon, played by Steve Easton, who has 157 credits, but his profile pic on IMDb is from Field of Dreams, so I guess that's his biggest role. He was also in the movie Matchstick Men with Nicolas Cage. Diamond Dog gets his very own cage. Next up, we meet Billy Bedlam, played by Nick Chinland, who was in Chronicles of Riddick, Training Day, a role he reprised on the TV series, and a whole bunch of TV, who also gets his own cage. And finally, Cyrus the Virus, played by John Malkovich, who is from In the Line of Fire. I love him in that movie. Red, Dangerous Liaisons, and being John Malkovich, and recently kind of gone to TV with The New Pope and Space Force. I enjoyed Space Force. Did either of you watch Space Force?
Oh, yeah, I loved it.
I couldn't get into it.
No?
No.
But Cyrus the Virus also gets his own cage. And in here, we also meet Pinball, who is played by comedian Dave Chappelle from Half-Baked, Robin Hood Men in Tights, The Dave Chappelle Show, and A Star is Born. I thought I'd throw him a bit of a heavier credit in there. Who is told by Guard Falzon that he is one skinny Negro, and it smells like someone shit in your mouth, but he told me he loved me. Great line from Dave Chappelle. I just don't understand, though, why the guards suddenly... Like, why... Is this just how guards are? Like, do we suddenly have to just become, you know, like, do-rag's gotta go, homeboy, and, the, you know, and who's this handsome brother? Like,
I think that's just, like, a staple of 90s... prison guards.
Yeah.
That whenever I think of any time you have a prison guard in an action movie, especially, their whole purpose is to dehumanize the inmates and stuff and that kind of thing. And yeah.
I got a theory on the prison guards and why they're so angry all the time. Yeah. And giving these prisoners a hard time. Imagine you're a prison guard, your name is Mike or Carl, and that's what you get called all the time, you know? And you're around these prisoners, and they got cool nicknames like Diamond Dog. Cyrus the Virus.
It's just too much for poor Chip, the prison guard.
Carl should just make his nickname. I would just walk around and be like, I'm Carl the Law Nightstick. There's so many sweet guard names you could have. They just have to grab it by the horns and take it.
We meet Johnny 23, who is played by Danny Trejo, who is from Dust Till Dawn. He's Machete. He's got 396 credits. Danny Trejo is in fucking everything.
His name is Johnny 23?
Yeah.
So they give everybody else a cool nickname. Diamond Dog, Cyrus the Virus, and this guy's Johnny 23. They just numbered him?
Yeah,
so there's 23 Johnnies out there?
It's for his 23 women he raped.
Because he's got the tattoo with all the hearts on his arm. And yeah, it's one for every of the 23. You know, he even says it would be
Johnny 1000.
Yeah, Johnny 600, I think it was. Yeah, or
maybe he's Johnny 5's brother from Short Circuit.
But yeah, in 1997 alone, he was in 6 movies. And not a single Nicolas Cage connection. But he was in a movie called Cage in 1987. That's the closest I could find.
Does he have a Samuel L. Jackson connection?
Oh, I don't. I was looking for Nick Cage movies when I went through his 396 credits.
When I saw Danny Trejo, I made a comment to my wife that, you know, this is a very young Danny Trejo because I've really only seen him in stuff like within the last 5 years.
Like Machete.
Yeah. And she took a look at him and was like, that's a young man? Like, he's so weathered in this movie.
But plus 20 years, right? Yeah, he's bragging about his tattoo that has a heart for every rape. And he's bragging to Cyrus, who hates rapists. And he tells the only female guard, Sally Bishop, who is played by Rachel Ticotin, who was in Total Recall, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, Man on Fire, Falling Down, Natural Born Killers. But her Natural Born Killers credit had brackets, scenes deleted. I've never seen that in all of my research with IMDb. But yeah, he tells her it would have been Johnny 600. Oh, see, I wrote it down. It would be Johnny 600 if people knew the truth. Also, we get Pinball saying some racist stuff to the native inmates seated with him. Like, sup, Cochise, how? Finally, we get to Poe getting off the bus, and we're told he's no one. Falzon takes his daughter's picture away. He says, just so you know, I'll be getting that back. Are you threatening me? You heard me. Oh, good old some good old Nicolas Cage sass. The assistant corrections officer, Ginny, is nervous about the situation. All those monsters on one plane. But Vince Larkin responds with a foreshadowing line of, Ginny, please. It's a well-oiled machine. What could possibly go wrong, Ginny? The undercover DEA agent is one of the last ones to get on board, and Malloy slips a gun into his sock. Baby O needs his insulin, but he'll get it as soon as they're airborne. I think it's time, though. I want to take a little break here for some show and tell. We decided that we wanted to start looking up merchandise and movie tie-ins. And so we found a few of our favorites here. So do you want to go first?
All I really found was one interesting historical fact. And that is just that the date of this movie is obviously July 14th. That's the day Cameron's getting out to go meet. Mm-hmm. But July 14th is also known as Bastille Day, which was the date of a prison break which started the French Revolution. And so I thought that was that, given that this is a prison break on a plane, I thought that was an interesting connection to a historical event.
Huh. That is kind of interesting. I wonder if that was actually intentional, or am I giving a Jerry Bruckheimer movie too much credit?
I think you're giving him too much credit, but we'll never know.
Well, a couple of the things I found, I went a different direction. If you go to redbubble.com, you can find a quarantine mask with a picture of Nick Cage on it with the quote, put the bunny back in the box. It only costs you $18.82. On Etsy, I found a sticker with Cyrus on it that says, make a move and the bunny gets it for $6.81. At hollywoodmemorabilia.com, you can get an 11x17, not very big, Con Air poster autographed by John Cusack for only $122.99.
Worth every penny.
And my favorite, though, that I found is if you go to fanfiction.net, you can find a story called Homemade Cookies and Love-Starved Murderers by Brunette Marionette. And here's a description of that fanfiction. When the warden's daughter, 5-year-old Nicole, stumbles upon Cyrus the Virus, she somehow manages to worm her way into his cold heart, but as she gets older, she soon becomes his obsession. Could she be a cure to the virus, or will Little Red Riding Hood succumb to the big bad wolf?
I don't like that. I don't like that at all.
And that's show and tell. Okay, so Guard Falzon gives his speech about how the inmates should treat their time on the plane like kindergarten. One of the inmates spits at him, and he elbows him and says, "Gag and bag this Nazi muffin. Equal opportunity racist." So at least the guards, they aren't just sticking to people outside of their race. He is insulting a white guy, too. While this is going on, the three caged inmates have been digging pins out of their skin to pick the locks of their handcuffs with. Shortly after takeoff, Pinball regurgitates a little vial of flammable liquid and a match and lights his seatmate on fire. In the commotion, Pinball gets the cages open. The pilots get the gun out of the lockbox up front. Cyrus wrestles it away, but a few people get shot and stabbed, including the guard that had the insulin. And now Cyrus has the only gun on board. Plane officially hijacked. The tower is told by the pilot, under threat of death, that everything is okay.
One thing I thought interesting about their whole breakout was that they're pulling, like, metal pins out of their hands and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I remember them getting patted down and, like, the guy takes the do-rag, but did metal detectors not exist at this point?
I'm kind of surprised that, yeah, that they got a pretty thorough frisking, but... Yeah, that they didn't have a wand dragged over their body or through a...
You would think if it's the worst of the worst, you might take, like, pull out all the stops.
Or at least a stop.
Yeah, let's not go overboard. Yeah, let's start at one and just go from there.
You can't have this do-rag, but that pin lodged in your palm. That's okay.
But maybe the shackles would just cause too much of a problem with metal detectors that it's not worth it.
I guess even if they would have probably just thought it was the shackles.
Yeah. So okay, there we go. Sorry, loophole closed on you there.
Case closed. Glad we got to the bottom of it.
So Cameron Poe protects Guard Bishop from getting molested by Johnny 23. They're making their plan for who gets off and on in Carson City, and everyone is getting unlocked. Undercover Agent Sims won't take this, pulls his gun, takes Pinball hostage. Cyrus says he doesn't care about the two-bit Negro crackhead and has Guard Bishop hostage. Poe is trying to hostage negotiate, but DEA agent Sims ends up dead, and now Poe is Cyrus's new hero. And then we get Pinball asking, "Did you really mean that two-bit N-word stuff?" Dave Chappelle obviously goes somewhere that John Malkovich and myself will not. We get Cyrus taking the gun, and he says, "Of course I did." It's just one of those, like, I love the little one-liners that are in this movie. Like, they're so stupid, they're so ridiculous, but they're so fun at the same time. So half the people who are supposed to be getting off in Carson City are now dead. So Poe and Baby O volunteer to get off because Baby O needs his insulin. He has a vial, but all the syringes are broken. But all the prisoners they're expecting in Carson City are white. So Poe says he'll raise the alarm when they land. And Cyrus thinks someone may have a change in conscience and is going to gag everyone. So Poe decides to stay, making up some bullshit about having a life sentence and wanting freedom instead of staying on. The pilot is white, so he takes his place. There's a sandstorm in Carson City, which is perfect cover. The prisoners are transferred, and we now get Swamp Thing on board, who is MC Gainey, who has 188 credits. He was in Wild Hogs, Club Dread. He played a walker in The Walking Dead, and he was in the movie Stolen with Nicolas Cage. We get to meet Sally Can't Dance. The thing I don't understand about Sally Can't Dance's name is they credit it as Sally-Can't and then Dance as the last name. Wouldn't the hyphen go between Can't and Dance instead? Shouldn't it be like Sally Can't Dance rather than Sally Can't Dance? I don't know.
I don't think they had a linguist on staff. Maybe they should have.
Sally Can't Dance was not the beneficiary of a snappy nickname. Because, you know, Diamond Dog is named for something luxurious. And Johnny, well, he's named for all the rapes that he did. Over 600, you say. And Pinball, you know, he's got his cool nickname. And then the Sally Can't Dance is just like, yeah, this person's flaw is they don't dance very well.
Yeah, but is Pinball a cool nickname?
Well, it's kind of cool. You know, it's a fun game you play.
Does it mean to get bounced around? Like, I'm not sure that's the nickname I want in prison.
No, no, I don't think
so. Knowing what happens in prison.
Yeah, I think I'd rather be the flippers of the pinball game.
Paddles?
because they're the ones that do the beating, not take the beating. Yeah, so Sally Can't Dance is played by Rinoli Santiago, who was in Hackers, Dangerous Minds, Daylight. They're on board, plus a few others. Swamp Thing is the new pilot. He removes the transponder, and Pinball is sent to hide it in a different plane. While this transfer is happening, Poe discovers that DEA agent Sims was wired with a tape recorder, so he stuffs it in Falzon's shirt, who is now dressed as a gagged inmate, under the pretense of looking for his daughter's picture that he had taken there earlier. Meanwhile, a search of Cyrus's old cell uncovers a planned plot involving Carson City before it blows up. Are they just that desperate to add more explosions and more chaos into this movie that somehow he wired his cell to explode?
Well, no, yeah. I mean, he has it in that little box that specifically says do not open, but the stupid guard opens it and blows the place to hell.
Yeah, and John Cusack narrowly avoids getting hit by a very CGI cell door that flies past him. So, last to board in Carson City is Garland Green, played by Steve Buscemi, who was in Reservoir Dogs as Mr. Pink, Pulp Fiction as Buddy Holly. I love his little cameo in Pulp Fiction. He's in Fargo, The Big Lebowski, he's an Adam Sandler regular, and of course he's an ex-firefighter who famously helped in the recovery efforts during 9/11. He's wearing a leather mask over his face, all Hannibal Lecter style. He's the craziest motherfucker of all of them. On the prison transport bus, with the prisoners that were just let off, the tape recorder has been found. Also, Larkin has notified Carson City they are supposed to stall. Cyrus senses something is up, kills the guy stalling, and gets the plane moving. Pinball, who has been delayed because he's flirting with a woman. You've got the prettiest eyes I've seen in 5 to 10. That's a great line from Pinball. He tries to run and catch up as the plane escapes, and they escape. The people on the scenic tours plane where Pinball left the transponder are told foreshadowingly, "This will be a day you won't forget." Meanwhile, on the con plane, we find out that they are going to be switching planes at Lerner Airfield, but they aren't going as fast as they should be because something is preventing the landing gear from going all the way up. So Poe, who is Cyrus's new best friend, and Diamond Dog are sent to the belly of the plane to find out what it is that's dragging them down. And it turns out Pinball almost made it onto the plane after all, but ended up crushed by the landing gear. Poe sees that they're flying over a city and gets the idea to write a message on Pinball with a marker, telling Larkin the next phase of the plan. He manages to release Pinball, who falls to the ground. And so on the ground, we get a car with a snooty old man complaining about the fact that a bird just shit on his windshield right after a car wash. And he leans out his window to wipe the windshield off with a Kleenex. Other than in the middle of winter, occasionally reaching out my window and smacking my wipers to break the ice off. Have you ever, like, cleaned a windshield physically like this by leaning out the window? That's what wipers are for, right?
Yeah.
Is it just because he got a car wash just now that he doesn't want the little arcs on his windshield? Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't understand leaning out the window to wipe his car. But Larkin has been meeting with Trisha and Casey Poe to try to figure out why Cameron didn't get off when he had a chance, realizes he now has a man on the inside, but Malloy doesn't believe it and takes off in a chopper to follow the transponder signal. But now Larkin gets a phone call from a cop who has found Pinball with Larkin's name written all over it. Again, the subtlety is definitely not there in a movie like this. There are no choppers or planes to get him to Lerner Field, so he steals Malloy's Azkicker Corvette and is trying to rally some troops on his very 90s cell phone. I love the nostalgia of that big old flip brick. Phone, the brick flip phone. I never actually had one of those. I think I started about the Nokia phase. Nokia was my first cell phone.
Oh, yeah.
So on the plane, Billy Bedlam has found Poe's box in the belly of the plane and has caught him in his lie. Poe has to kill him after telling him to put the bunny back in the box, which is, I guess, his John Wick moment. I like to picture Nicolas Cage in John Wick at this moment right here. Can you imagine how much worse that movie would have been? Because you'd have crazy now Nicolas Cage as John Wick. I love the John Wick movies, but...
I haven't seen them yet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Wow. Okay. That's one for your
list.
Please
cut that out. I don't want people to know.
go watch John Wick. Poe gets back to his seat. Garland observes that two went down, one came up. We also find out that he once drove through three states wearing a woman's head as a hat. I fucking love Steve Buscemi. somehow, Larkin has made it to the airfield faster than a plane.
I mean, the Corvette can fly.
I mean, it's a nice Corvette, but, like, did they have to, like, completely backtrack? Is that, was he actually closer to Lerner Field because they did a full U-turn after Carson City to throw them off?
Yeah, this film benefits a lot from me having no idea how the geography works. I don't know where anything is in relation to where they're going.
Yeah, Larkin has beat them there. The plane lands just as another small plane lands coming the other way. And the pilot of the small plane does the old tuck and roll out of the moving plane. That seems a little excessive. I get it. Like, you know, your cornering ability in a plane when it's actually driving, like when it's actually on the ground, is not very good. But tuck and roll, like, that, yeah, it just seems a little excessive to me. But the con plane almost crashes into a propane tank and it gets partially buried. And even though they have another plane lined up, because that's their whole reason for landing at Lerner Airfield, they are tasked with digging it out again. Like, before they even find out that the plane's not there waiting for them, they're like, oh, get that shit out of there. It's like, did they just know? Did he just have another feeling? Diamond Dog wants to kill the guards, but Poe manages to save them. He is also on a mission to find a syringe for Baby O's insulin. Needs to find a first aid kit. And the first one he finds is filled with onions and chicken feet for some inexplicable reason. The plane that was set up by Francisco. So that's the name I was trying to think of earlier. So maybe it's Francisco that is the drug kingpin, because he's the one that has set up this plane.
Maybe.
Yeah, so the plane that was set up by Francisco, we find out, is planning on doing the old double cross and just taking Francisco away. Poe stumbles across these guys at the same time as Larkin, and they take out Francisco's friends and are now in a standoff with each other.
You're right, Francisco Cedeno. That's the guy that the de-agent was supposed to be sat next to.
Okay, so Poe tells him that I only trust two people. One's me, the other's not you. And then Larkin asks him, what are you going to do? What do you think I'm going to do? I'm going to save the fucking day. Oh, yeah. And rap horns go off. Wah, wah, wah. Nicolas Cage drops his mic. Bitch. I may have embellished that last little bit. But yes, he is going to save the fucking day. Garland Green has wandered off and found a little girl having a tea party in a drained pool. He sits with her for a bit. She asks, are you sick? And he says, there's no cure for what I have. And he sings, he's got the whole world. He's such a lovable creep.
One of the things, I don't know if this would insult me or not, but I read that Garland Green was written with Steve Buscemi in mind. And so, given the character, I don't know if I would feel complimented by that.
Well, you know, I think, here's my theory on that. Billy Madison came out in 1993, I think. It was definitely before this. And Billy Madison, he's the one that Billy phones and apologizes.
Yeah.
And then he's like putting the lipstick on and crossing him off his, like, his revenge.
Yeah.
So maybe writing Garland Green with him in mind is based on what he saw. Yeah. A cross between what he saw in like Fargo and...
No, that's a good point. And
Billy Madison. Billy friggin' Madison is what got us Garland Green. So Francisco and the one person Poe and Larkin didn't take out try to take off. Larkin stops the plane with a crane that works for some reason. I'm impressed that everything in this boneyard seems to work when they want it to. But Cyrus kills Francisco, but we get the line of Francisco going, "Wait, Cy!" And then Cyrus says, "Onara." Boom. More rap horns. Wait, wait, wait!
Oh, this movie. This movie deserves to be tried for war crimes.
I'm just picturing the guy whoever wrote it in their like in their dark basement at their computer writing that and be like, that's so funny, they'll laugh at them.
So they see the cops coming from a distance. They come up with a quick plan to trap them in the alley of the boneyard, where they've set up a crude model. This crude model always makes me think of Back to the Future when Doc Brown says, you know, "Sorry about the crudeness of the model. I didn't have time to paint it." No, that's okay, Doc. That's okay. So that's what this is like. He's got the rocks lined up and the tin cans in the middle. And the one guy asks, "What's that?" And Cyrus says, "It's a rock." So we find out that this small, quote-unquote, arsenal that was in the belly of the plane ends up being, like, fairly big. Like, they've got some pretty heavy-duty firepower in the belly of this plane. And they're carrying way more guns than there were guards.
Well, there's two problems. Like, one thing is the foreshadowing a little bit before when they're like, "Well, hopefully they don't find the storage locker or whatever with all the guns."
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, like, it's a transport plane. Everybody's going to be shackled. What do you need? Like, you need pistols on a plane. You don't need machine guns.
So I'm surprised they didn't have, like, flamethrowers and a good old, big old RPG. Yeah. So Poe finds an old man cowering under his truck and learns that there's an old fire truck nearby that should have a first aid kit that has a syringe. The cops show up. There's a big firefight. All the rusted vehicles in the boneyard seem to work, that they can drive them around and use them as shields. All the criminals fall back to the plane. Poe tries to tie it to a pillar. Cyrus sees it, that it's tied up when they're trying to take off. They shoot themselves free. They escape again. The rope that's dragging manages to hook onto the ass-kicker Corvette before taking off, and it's being pulled behind. And one of my favorite Con Air lines, I mean, as cheesy and brilliant as all the dialogue is, my favorite line is when he's standing there, Nicolas Cage, and he sees the Corvette flying behind him, and he says, "On any other day, that might seem strange." Like, that is hands down one of my favorite lines in Con Air. So Malloy sees the car from the ground, and no way it could be his, because his is parked back at the office. And he discovers it is when it falls off the plane, and they see the Azkicker license plate. Malloy and Larkin get into choppers to follow them. We also find out that Garland Green didn't kill the little girl, but he did get a Ken doll as a prize for hanging out with souvenir. The girl. Souvenir. So it's sweet. Singing, he's got the whole world, changed his whole perspective on life, maybe. So on the plane, everyone is dancing and celebrating to Sweet Home Alabama. Ah! I jumped the gun. This is my favorite Con Air line. Is when Garland Green says, "Define irony. A bunch of idiots dancing on a plane to a song made famous by a band that died in a plane crash."
Yeah.
Yeah. I also, when I was researching, Redbubble also has t-shirts that have that on it. Redbubble.com. throw us a sponsorship, Redbubble. Diamond Dog has found the letter from Poe's daughter saying that her dad is coming home. And he uses Guard Bishop to flush out the Good Samaritan who alerted cops and tried to tie up the plane. Baby O says that it was him to try to protect Poe. and he gets shot in the stomach. And yeah, this is where I thought that him dying is so Bubba from Forrest Gump. Cyrus says, "Don't move," or the bunny gets it, just as the choppers show up and start shooting at them. Larkin is trying to get them to stop. Who actually has jurisdiction here, the DEA or the Department of Corrections?
DEA is federal. Have they crossed state lines yet? I don't know.
Well, yeah, you were already saying that you don't know the geography of where they even are.
They're in Nevada for sure. I know that much.
Well, I guess so. Jordan, DEA or Corrections? What would be your vote?
Neither one. I think at this stage, Nicolas Cage has jurisdiction. Clearly taking the law into his own hands. The guy was thrown in prison for killing a guy with his fists. And then when he's about to be let out of prison, he goes around killing a bunch of people with his fists. Getting himself tossed back in the slammer.
He's a regular MacGyver. Like he doesn't need a gun. He doesn't like guns.
That actually would have been a fitting ending to this movie if at the end they were like, "Well, it was all Poe, obviously," and they just threw him right back.
He murders like a dozen people on this airplane.
Yeah, you were parole, but even taking a criminal's life, that's going to add a few years. So Poe manages to get control of the cockpit even after getting shot in the arm, and he radios the choppers to back off. In a tense moment, Malloy gets them to stand down. They're gonna try to land in Vegas, but they've had an engine shot out and they're losing fuel. They're gonna have to land on the strip. So they're going down as Garland Green sings his reprise of "He's Got the Whole World in His Hands." They end up crashing through the giant guitar of the Hard Rock Casino before chaotically using the Vegas Strip as a runway, shearing off pieces of the plane as they go, before finally crashing into the front door of a casino and destroying a second Corvette in the process. The helicopters have landed. One of them has Trisha and Casey Poe in it. Oh, there's going to be this big reunion of the family. All of the cops are trying to sort everything out and count up the inmates, including Johnny 23, who was handcuffed inside the plane when he tried to rape Guard Bishop at Lerner Airfield. And he's now armless and dead. I do like that part as well. That might be my third favorite moment of Con Air is the, "Well, this one's dead," and then they pull the body away and the arm's still hanging there from the handcuffs. Guard Bishop thanks Poe and tells him next time take the bus. Poe sees Cyrus, Diamond Dog, and Billy Bedlam escape out of a hatch on the bottom of the plane, and they steal a fire truck. And the most logical reaction for someone just paroled from prison, "Let's steal a police motorcycle and go after him." So well, Agent Larkin also has seen Cyrus and steals the motorcycle right beside him. And we have this kinship moment where before they tear off the fire truck, they just kind of nod at each other and "Let's go get him."
The one thing I always find comical in these movies is the fact that, like, in the world of movies, police bikes seemingly are always just sitting on the street with the keys ready.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they don't ever, like, the police never take the keys with them. They're always just ready for public use.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's just like in movies how people always keep the keys of their car in their visor. I've never kept my keys in my fucking visor.
Ever.
Ever. Like, that makes no sense to me. I already feel weird having my garage door opener in my on the visor of my car. That's why I keep my garage door locked. So the fire truck tears past some cops on Fremont Street. And we get a little close-up of a donut being dropped on the ground. And those cops join in the pursuit. Poe and Larkin end up on the fire truck. Poe fighting Cyrus on the ladder and Larkin on the roof shooting a hole and filling up the cabin with water from the hose. There are so many weapons at your disposal on a fire truck. I would have liked to see the jaws of life pulled out and being used by Larkin on the roof of the car. So
seen him kill the guy with the jaws of life. It would have been real ironic.
How was he killed? By irony. So Poe ends up managing to handcuff Cyrus to a ladder. Actually, before we get to that, he climbs along the bottom of the ladder, and I'm someone that I went through a phase where I watched a lot of American Ninja Warrior. And on American Ninja Warrior, what's his name? Matt Eisman and Akbar Abijamila? No, I don't remember his name. Anyway, they would always talk about the ninjas and how they were keeping perfect L's with their arms as they were going across things. And I must say, Nicolas Cage, solid L's. Solid L's on his arms as he was scaling that. It's good, great form. And, you know, it just shows all that badassery in the beginning where he was doing all those push-ups and upside-down push-ups and balancing on his arms in a seated position. They paid off. He was jacked in this movie. But, yeah, so Poe ends up handcuffing Cyrus to a ladder and raising it up to make him crash through a pedway, and then he goes flying, even though he was handcuffed. I don't know how he did that, but he goes flying. He lands on some power lines. He ends up on a conveyor belt at a rock crushing yard, where he goes over the conveyor belt, lands underneath it, and gets crushed by the rock crusher. Nothing like overkill to cap off this movie. That right there, folks, is how you do the climax of a movie. That's how you kill off your villain. Screw this breaking Zod's neck in Man of Steel. No, we need flying through a pedway, landing on electrical wires, and then crushed by a rock crusher.
Why is there a rock crusher
in the middle of Vegas?
Middle of the Vegas.
Well, see, they've now gone past Fremont Street, and I've been to Vegas, and once you get past Fremont Street, which is old Vegas,
Yeah. That's
where it starts getting a little seedier. But I also don't understand this, because right now that Cyrus is dead, you know, that's what you get for threatening Poe's daughter, but somehow this chase has ended right back where it started, because Poe rescues the stuffed rabbit from going down into the sewer. You know, so did they just do a big circle? So that would kill my theory about the fact that this has taken them beyond the regular Vegas Strip.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It just, we need a map. We need to know where Lerner Airfield is. I should have Googled all this before doing this. I should have map quested that shit. So
we can post on the Facebook page the travel outline.
Yeah. check our social medias. Yeah, that's right. We'll post some maps on. We'll do some trip planning on.
Hey everybody, Editing Sean here. Lucky you get to hear from me twice in one episode. I just wanted to say that in my research while I was trying to put together this map, I discovered that Lerner Airfield is actually completely fictitious. The scenes in the movie were filmed at Wendover Airfield in Utah, but as for Lerner Airfield, completely made up. Who knew? So unfortunately, this map that I was hoping to compile for you and post on our social media is not going to happen. Also, I did want to say that in my research, I discovered that in the original ending of the movie, they were supposed to crash land on the front lawn of the White House, which, geographically, that also makes absolutely no sense. He's incarcerated in San Quentin, which is in California. They have to go through Nevada in order to get to Louisiana, but Washington, D.C. is way in the north. It just would have made no sense at all. Unless, of course, they moved the location of the prison that Cameron Poe was incarcerated in. And while I'm on that subject, why was someone that was convicted in Alabama incarcerated in California anyway? There's just a whole bunch that doesn't make sense in this movie. But we love this movie anyway. Back to the show.
So, Poe now tells Larkin that he now trusts three men. I kind of wanted Larkin to go, okay, is one of them me? Huh? Nick Cage, is one me? Huh?
So, all Nick Cage, all three of them.
Just different versions of him. Yeah. He trusts National Treasure Nick Cage. He trusts leaving Las Vegas Nick Cage, even though he was an alcoholic. So he finally, Cameron Poe gets reunited with his wife and daughter in the most awkward family moment ever, when he tries to give her the soaking wet dirty rabbit and wipes it off on his dirty tank top to give to her, and then his her mom telling her to hug her daddy. Yeah. he's got a gunshot wound, he wanted to get a haircut, and we get this awkward hug. And then we get Leanne Rimes again, and we get credits. And, you know, I have to say, I actually like that Leanne Rimes song. I'm not a big country guy, but I've got a soft spot for this Leanne Rimes song. And I know it's only because of this movie.
Yeah.
And I know the other Leanne Rimes song is also because of Jerry Bruckheimer that I like. It's the Can't Fight the Moonlight from Coyote Ugly. That's another Leanne Rimes song that I'm a little partial to. So that is Con Air. Now, Colin Jordan. Oh, on IMDb, it scored 6.9 out of 10. Only 6.9 out of 10. A Metascore from the critics of 52. On Rotten Tomatoes, it had 55% from their critics on the tomato meter. And an audience rating of 75%. They liked it a bit more. Before we get to our opinions, Colin, what did others have to say? Do we have some critics talking to us?
Yeah, so I took my reviews this week from the Google Reviews service, and I thought it was really interesting because on Google Reviews, there's no rating that's lower than 3 stars, 3 out of 5 stars. I thought for sure. There's 77 reviews. I thought for sure there would be
at least one 1-star
review, but I was just, people love, like, the average, people love this movie. It's awesome. So, our first review comes from David King, who says, quite simply, one of the most wonderful films ever made. Imagine a blend of The Room with Die Hard, and you have one of the most entertainingly hilarious films ever made. Add a bottle of wine, and you won't stop laughing. Every actor plays their part with panache, and the CGI rivals anything Michael Bay can offer. And with Skinner's Sweet Home Alabama as a soundtrack, it's an experience to enjoy again and again.
Wow. Panache.
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 Michael Kunzelman, I hope I said that right, says...
Is it with a C?
It's with a K.
Okay. Well, let's go Kunzelman. Okay,
Kunzelman says, arguably the best role ever for most, if not all, of its cast. Buscemi, Malkovich, Cage, Cusack, Trejo, and the curly-headed guy that plays the DEA agent. Memorable scenes, brilliantly hilarious dialogue, and great, however unbelievable, storyline. This movie actually gets better with rewatching because most of us don't quite pick up everything offered here the first time through. Defines a classic. And then,
wow, the curly-headed guy, like, he's writing a review online and he couldn't even like pull out IMDb for 10 seconds.
And then finally,
yeah, he's on Google. The curly-headed guy from Con Air, that's all you need to type in.
And then finally, the last one I have here comes from Cindy Wana. And she says, I love watching, especially how Nicolas Cage looks so great. The muscles he got on his body for that movie is awesome. And how he kept that accent was amazing. You know you are going to be watching a great movie if it has John Malkovich, John Cusack, and Nicolas Cage.
Right on. So there's the critics. Yeah, so where does this fall for you? We've got, like I said, 6.9. We've got 75. That's audience scores. 52 and 55 for critics.
I mean, I give it an 80%.
Yeah?
I think it's... When I think of good action movies, I think of Con Air. And I haven't watched it in a while, but watching it last night, I still thought it was awesome. I still enjoyed it. Nicolas Cage, I mean, he's kind of a caricature at this point of himself, but... I don't know. I still think this movie is great.
Yeah, because this was definitely before he turned extra crazy. Jordan, what about you, bud?
Well, Sean, I'm glad you asked. And but before I answer, I just want to say it's been a pleasure speaking with you and Colin. Really, really enjoyed this. I'm going to give Con Air a one-star review because one star is all you need, and that star is Nicolas Cage. And I mean that as an absolute compliment. I'm going to give this movie a 420 out of 10. Nice. Because this movie is the be-all, end-all. I still think the criminals who stole the plane were intended to start their own airline, and things just kind of went awry. Yeah. And I think it's entirely possible this movie was secretly directed by Mel Brooks.
Well, you know, you could always go on to thefanfiction.net and you could write the sequel to this or the alternate universe version of this where they are just starting an airline. It's basically Catch Me If You Can with hardened criminals. Yeah, you know, I feel like I have to kind of agree with where Colin is. Like, this movie, it's goddamn, it is lowest common denominator all across the board. Mindless action. But I had a fucking great time. I mean, you know, I still love this movie. I still, all those movies, like the ones that I mentioned, like Gone in 60 Seconds, The Rock, you know, all those ones, just these big, stupid popcorn movies. God, it's still just, have a good time.
It reminds me so much of, like, just that 90s, like, man's man movie. Like, there's no definable female lead whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's just pure action, all the one-liners, all the guns, all the explosions. It's just, yeah, it's just one of those movies I feel like is just you drink a beer, have some fun,
yeah,
and go for the ride,
or a bottle of wine, like our one review there. Well, there we go. That is Con Air. A big huge thank you to our special guest this week, Jordan Ward. Jordan, if people want to find you on the old interwebs, where can they do so?
Oh, well, they can check out my stuff on goodimprov.com. I do some comedy articles and stuff there. And a podcast, we do a sketch comedy podcast as well. And all our social media is at Good Improv, so you can find us there on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Fantastic. Yeah, I know... you guys were putting out a lot of at-home content while we were under lockdown here, and I checked a few of them out, and definitely a good time. Are you guys still doing that since theaters aren't quite open yet, or?
Oh, we are. We're doing live streams. We're aiming for every week. We sort of had a bit of a break for the month of August, but we're coming back soon, tonight, actually. We had our first show on G-Radio again.
Right on.
And we're doing... live stream comedy wraps every Friday, live stream sketch comedy every Thursday, and we're going to be doing live stream video game every Wednesday. That all goes down 8 o'clock on Facebook.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I was going to say. Yeah, look for them on Facebook because I know that's where I've gotten my notifications for their shows. Thank you again so much for being here, Jordan. If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to go to Apple or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever app you listen to your podcast on. Sorry, not Spotify. Made this mistake again. go to Apple Podcasts or Stitcher and give us 5 stars. Doesn't really matter what you say. You can tell us your favorite Nicolas Cage movie. It's not for our egos. It's just to give us 5 stars and drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
And check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you'll find links to our Facebook page, our Instagram, all our social medias, our Twitter. You can also reach out to us, contact us by email at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. Social media is going to be your best bet to see what movies we're watching so that you can watch them and then come enjoy the show.
I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter in the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Thanks for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.